TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Helen Caldicott in conversation with Michael Krasny. This is a rare, very personal conversation between the Australian physician, anti-nuclear activist, and author, Dr. Helen Caldicott, and the public radio talk show host, Michael Krasny. They met with a group of doctors at the University of San Francisco Medical Center in April 1999. Helen Caldicott is well known for not mincing any words about the dangers of nuclear weapons, and Krasny, a personal friend and admirer of hers for over 20 years, felt compelled to say at the beginning that those present should be open to her message in spite of the serious content. Here is Michael Krasny.
What you discover about Helen is that she speaks with a kind of passion and vitality that inspires hope, and not only that, but she empowers people. And I use that word advisedly because it's probably overused these days, but she makes people feel just the opposite of what you might think you would feel when you look at some of the haunting and horrible specters of the nuclear madness that we've been caught up in, lo, these many years. Helen, let me again extend my warm welcome to you and begin by asking about concerns that I presume you may have now. Since the Cold War has been over, there's been probably a great number of sighs of relief, and yet those like yourself, I know, have sent out the caveats that there's probably should be maybe even more concern, more anxiety, 20,000 missiles ready to be launched, extraordinary number of difficulties with respect to the potential for nuclear disaster. If we were talking about the nuclear clock, where do you see it now? Closer, even, than it was in the Cold War?
Yeah, well, without Y2K, I'd say it would be 5 minutes to midnight. But with Y2K, maybe it's two.
I mean, I'm assuming that a lot of your apprehension about Y2K and a lot of your concern and anxiety over it has to do with Russia's beleaguered computer systems. But do you see problems here as well or other places?
Oh, yeah. Everything's computerized now. People can't even add up in the bank. You know, they have to use these things. I mean, the brain's sort of atrophying from disuse. But the computers have taken over the functions of our brain. And they have, really. So the chemical plants, for instance, Michael, they're just full of embedded chips, and they make all sorts of toxins, which is great for the chemical companies. But it's projected there will be some Bhopals, and maybe in the toxic corridor on the East Coast, but they're all over the world. The nuclear power plants, they're scary. There are 433 in the world, 103 in America. And they have some embedded chips, and every nuclear power plant here is a different design, whereas France, they're all standardized and the same. But so they don't really know where the embedded chips are and the like. But that's not the main problem, I think, because most of them are analog. You can press buttons, pull, you know, turn dials, although the cooling water is digitalized. But you see, they're dependent upon an external source of electricity for the cooling water to circulate at 1 million gallons a minute. And if it doesn't circulate, bango. So the problem is the grid. Now, there are 5 major grid systems in the US, and embedded chips or software can bring them down. So, you know, say an embedded chip brings down your grid system. How do you find the embedded chip when there's no electricity to make the diagnosis? It's like me trying to do an EEG when your heart stopped beating and there's no blood circulating, or an EKG. You can't. So how do you make a diagnosis of an aberrant embedded chip and find it when there's no electricity in the system, you see? That's the first thing. The second thing, someone who's working on the software in the Northeast grid recently said it's just a nightmare. Now, most of the nuclear reactors in America are in the Northeast. And if they lose their electricity, they melt down in minutes. Minutes. Now, if you turn them off the day before New Year's Day, they melt down in 30 minutes. So how do we stop them melting down? If the grid goes off, and I'm just talking about the US now, you have to have backup diesel generators, which are 75% reliable, 85%. So if I said to you, your heart's 85% reliable, you wouldn't be too happy. No.
And so, the lack of preparation is stunning in all this? Or?
Well, the NRC, you know, is virtually paid for, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, by the utilities. They really run it. They don't really represent our health and well-being. And they were sort of testing 12 plants and said, you know, and the plants are testing themselves. There's no external compliance or anything. And they said, well, if you're not Y2K compliant by July, we'll smack your bottoms. But they weren't testing all the plants. Now they've decided maybe they might actually test all the plants and they'd better have a supply of diesel fuel, but they're really nervous. And if you read the net, read the website from the NRC, progressively they get more nervous. And in fact, at the symposium I organised on this, the NRC bloke was heard to say in the hall afterwards, well, we're preparing for two emergencies.
That means actually, the last time we did a radio program with somebody from the NRC, they were sounding like they were getting off the dime and
sort of
being nervous. Yeah, that's
a now that, and so then all the power plants in the world, 67 Russian reactors, they don't even have backup diesel generators. There are 70 reactors in submarines in the Barents Sea, old Russian reactors in the subs. They have to be kept cool. And the other day, the Electricity Commission in Russia said, look, we're going to not supply with electricity because you haven't paid your bill to the people who run these reactors. And then we're going to shut off the electricity. Well, there was a hell of an outcry. And someone paid the bill. But if the electricity stops, there could be 70 Chernobyls just there in the Barents Sea, let alone the 67 huge reactors around Russia and the ex-Soviet Union, let alone France, who's got 80% of its electricity coming from nuclear power. So Einstein was right when years ago he said the splitting of the atom changed everything, save man's mode of thinking. Thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. At the moment, we're drifting fast.
As long as we're bringing up all these hazards, I just received a book from somebody from Kazakhstan who was in charge of the biological warfare research that I'm sure the name is probably familiar to you, and the book is called Biohazard, and what he's trying to say is that the sort of research that's been going on, especially with the kind of souped-up anthrax and everything, ought to give us all terrible pause and really represents, again, a real potential for a serious global catastrophe. Some thoughts about that from you?
Yeah, not like nuclear war, though. That really doesn't grab me. I mean, the Pentagon's big into weapons of mass destruction now, biological weapons and chemical. The truth is the Pentagon's been working on biological weapons forever and has been leading the way, as always, and has been doing genetic engineering on bacteria in their P5 or 4 labs when they were told they shouldn't, but they have. And they've been leading the way on chemical warfare, although they signed a treaty, I think, to abolish chemical weapons. It's just another boogeyman to bring up so we can keep the nuclear weapons, because the policy now is, used to be, we will not bomb any country that's not nuclear. That's changed. Now we'll bomb any little country that has all weapons of mass destruction, which is a few anthrax spores on a weapon. Yeah, anthrax is pretty bad. Polio is bad. But we're talking about destroying the biosphere, Michael. And you only need 1,000 bombs on 100 cities to create nuclear winter and the end of life on Earth. And this country's got 2,500 ready to go at the drop of a hat or a press of a button, so is Russia. And the most heavily computerized system in the world is the Pentagon. And they're being what they call opaque. They're not really telling us how they're going on Y2K compliance.
Let's segue to that. We can, of course, come back to the arms race. The healthcare system now, I mean, it seems as though we're not going to get national health care, despite the fact that many of us have labored diligently to try to bring it about. It seems as if we've got a kind of HMO out of control, bean counting world of that sort of medicine. And it also seems as though a lot of our resources are seriously ought to be of concern to us. What do you think needs to be done to repair or fix or mend our healthcare system?
Well, I just think the Americans should rise up and say, for God's sake, stop stealing our money and giving it to the robber barons, which are Lockheed Martin and General Electric and Hughes Aircraft, to make these weapons. Stop stealing our money for $300 billion a year for a Pentagon that should cease to exist, because there's no Cold War, there's no enemy, and take your money back and
use
it.
When you say there's no enemy, let me just for a moment. Of course, the quick thing when they come to Washington and asking for money, they say, but there are the rogue states, there are the terrorists, there are still things that we have to worry about and we have to arm ourselves against.
But why? It's got nothing to do with America. It's none of America's business.
We're the superpower, is the argument.
You have no right to be policing the rest of the world. We don't like it. We don't. You got rid of my
prime minister. You don't mean the Aussies, I take it. Right?
Yeah, well, Aussies. Well, they're a bit sycophantal at the moment to America, but on the whole, we don't. Europe doesn't like it either, although they're going along with this. You know, America deposed my prime minister in 1974. I don't like that. I mean, that makes me really angry. And America needs to look after itself and get out of the rest of the world. Leave us alone. Have some humility. Work with the United Nations. Get rid of the Pentagon. Move the expertise and technical expertise and manpower to the UN and work in the community of nations together.
And pay off your debt.
And pay off your $1.6 billion. And have some humility. Know that we don't like you being a superpower. To hell with you. I mean, I really mean that.
I know you do, Helen.
Damn.
But let's go back to day-to-day healthcare.
Okay.
Okay. To make healthcare better, to ameliorate some of the problems we have.
Well, you see, I don't think you can fix it unless you get to the cause. The problem with the medical care system is it's rotten from the core. It's cancerous. It's been taken over by insurance companies. And drug companies are now buying insurance companies and telling us what drugs we can and can't prescribe. I mean, what an aberration of medicine. And then for the insurance companies to make money, and the CEOs pay themselves huge amount of money, this isn't medicine. And to talk about the medical industry makes me just shrivel, because medicine is not an industry. Medicines are sacred.
Of course it is. Yeah.
Well, yeah, not to the doctors, you'll find. Yeah, there are some doctors who get unreasonably rich, and they should not. And I think teachers should be paid more than we are. They have a greater responsibility towards society than do we.
Hear, hear.
We cure a few sore throats. And then we get to insurance. You know, 42 million people are not insured, and they fall between the cracks, and they can't get health care. This is, I mean, I've just been a junior paediatric intern in Australia for 7 months at the Sydney Children's Hospital. We've got the best medical care system in the world, without a doubt. And patients stay as long as they need, drugs are given, money's never mentioned, the clinical care is excellent, and it's all paid for by our federal government. You can get private insurance if you want, but if you're really sick, you don't go to a private hospital, because you can bleed to death in the middle of the night with no interns. You go to a public hospital. Now, the HMOs are starting to infiltrate into our country, and I've got to fix that. I'm going to go back and make sure it doesn't happen, because... So I don't understand... See, we Australians wouldn't understand why you don't demand and almost have a revolution over the fact that you don't have free healthcare, you see. I mean, fancy being in the emergency room in the middle of the night with a patient and you have to ring a clerk with a computer, with a high school education, saying, can I treat the patient thus and thus? And she presses on, and she says no. I mean, I wouldn't. If I worked in the system, I wouldn't take that. I'd fight them. I'd do what had to be done for the patient, you know, and I would not refer. Well, maybe I wouldn't get paid, you know, but you're not in medicine to get paid. You're in medicine to help the patient, because you took the Hippocratic Oath. That's why you're in medicine.
It's refreshing to hear that kind of idealism still. Wonderful and inspiring. And I wonder how you keep it, how you keep the fires fresh in you. And I mean that quite sincerely, because they are just as fresh now as they were when I first met you almost 20 years ago. The sense that you are, and then I want to ask you about triage in terms of the causes that you have committed yourself to, because I think I imagine that the nuclear is tops because that's the most dangerous, but then how you go from that point forward. But just in terms, it might be useful, I think, for people to hear how you keep this passion that you obviously have about the issues that you speak out on and continue to speak out on.
I don't know.
What about the question of triage then? I mean, how do you decide?
I suppose I could say when I was a very, very little girl, one of the first stories I ever heard was The Good Samaritan. That had a big impact on me.
Yes, I remember you writing
and
about
that. Yeah, I used to lie in bed and tell my dad, they beat him and they hit him, and the first man went by and left him, and the second man went by and left him, and the third one stopped and bathed his wounds with oil and bandaged him and cared for him. And I think that had a big impression on me. I also had a near-death experience as a baby. And so I've always been pretty scared of dying. I nearly did die. And so for me, life is inordinately precious.
When you decide on what to put as uppermost in terms of what you campaign for or what you see as your mission, the nuclear, because obviously it has the most serious and devastating kind of potential for destruction. But then how do you decide after that? Is that the litmus test to some extent? Or,
Yeah, I read On the Beach when I was 15, and that's bottom line. And you know...
Anybody ever read On the Beach, the Neville Shute novel still?
Good. You see the film, yes.
Because it woke me up to nuclear disaster, too, in many ways.
Then I did biology, and I learned about Muller's experiments with Drosophila fruit fly and radiation, and I saw the fallout. I mean, it all just slotted into place, and I saw these mad idiots making bombs and never understood their mentality, still don't. But, and also very cross, and I guess also cross too, because I think women hold a key to a lot of the world's future, and 53% of us are women, and we should have proportional representation in every parliament of the world. We really should, and we can make a huge difference. Now, women tend to be a bit regressive. No, that's not the word I'm saying, but they step back. They'll come up really fired up after I speak, and I say, run for Congress, and I'll say, oh, me? I think that's the estrogen factor. And I'll say it to a man, he'll say, yeah. And that's the testosterone factor. And I think not to understand that we're very, very different psychologically, because these hormones have a big influence on our brains.
What do you say?
Silly.
I think I may have asked you this once before, but you know, there's this interesting remark that's made from time to time about Indira Gandhi, Golda Meir, and Maggie Thatcher all having been involved in wars.
Yeah, well, you know, they're 0.00000 10⁻⁹% of the female population, right? And how did they get to be there? By emulating men, I guess. And the magic number is 30%, below which women tend to emulate men and please men. Above 30% numbers in parliament or whatever, women tend to reinforce each other's philosophy and feeling, and they'll vote for milk for children and get rid of bombs and that sort of thing. And this needs to be tried. It has to be a big sea change, a sort of almost a revolution in attitude and thinking to create that. Maybe Y2K might help if it's a bit of a disaster.
You say that with a smile, as if, you know, the big wake-up call is what we need, like the giant wake-up call.
That's clear.
Yeah.
That's very clear.
I need to ask you, because we had talked about this before we began having this conversation when we were just seated, a little bit about mental health and about what you make of, I mean, you as a longtime observer of America and someone who has been passionate in your outspoken criticism of an event like the one that occurred in Colorado.
Guns.
The accessibility of
guns.
Guns, yeah.
There are always kids who are into teenage years who become somewhat psychotic, and many of them become depressed. And guns and television, I guess, you know, these god-awful violent shows, and you know, they're the ones that Hollywood makes, and the young boys go. And it's violence with no feeling at all, flat affect,
it's
nothing,
also
you know?
Kind of nihilism and love of death, isn't it, in some ways? I mean, that's what's peculiar about it.
That who loves death?
These boys who were involved...
No, I don't think they understand what death means. Certainly children... I'm a pediatrician, and kids have no idea of what death really means. They think, well, I'll just die and show mummy and daddy and come back. And I think, too... in young adolescents, they have a sense of immortality, and I don't think they really, really realize.
These boys wanted literally to bomb their school out of existence.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the national ethos, isn't it? America's been wanting to blow up the Earth out of existence. That's been the subliminal message. We've all, we're the children of the nuclear age, growing up with a sense of nihilism, that we may easily have no future. That's been the ethos since 1945 or thereabouts. So they're just reflecting this society, aren't they? I look at the Pentagon, I mean, all that, and you hear these generals talking about the war. By God, they're awful. There's a totally flat affect, and all the language is this awful military stuff. I've got a friend who's an admiral, Jean LaRoque, and he said, you know, our mission is to destroy property and kill people. That's what they're doing, and it's evil. It's evil.
Why do you suppose they're doing it?
I think there's a screw loose in the human brain. And I think we're the only species that kill ourselves like this, mass killing, except the lemmings who run off the cliffs. And we kill other species too with impunity. No other species do that. And we are an animal. We are an animal, one of 30 million. We don't know our place in the world with all the other species. We're so anthropocentric. But we get the smell of blood in our nostrils and, by God, we're off. And everyone stands behind the flag and salutes. And you know, when I first started in 78, better dead than red was the ethos, and everyone was behind it. Till we said, do you know what happens if a bomb drops on San Francisco? No? Ooh. Well, your eyes melt. What? Well, you get terribly burnt and really? And millions will be vaporized. And then they'd say, ooh, well, nuclear war's bad for our health. Well, we can't be better dead than red. We'd better... So you'd have to break through the psychic numbing and penetrate their soul so that they could feel it. I don't know. I mean, we do have to look at the fundamental pathology, and I regard it as pathology, this killing. And now we've perfected it to such a degree. I mean, fancy how gutless can the Americans be that they go and bomb from the air with these incredibly dreadful cluster bombs and the like, and they don't even get down on the ground. Who are they killing? Civilians. Yeah, they're not killing the
Muslims.
Not
only Yugoslavia, of course.
But it's revolting. I
mean, under Clinton, in the last 7 months, we bombed, I believe, 4 different countries.
Iraq and
Sudan and Afghanistan.
Sudan, Afghanistan. Oh, really? Afghanistan? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, you've got to use the weapons because, you see, they have to be made again. And each cruise missile is worth $1 million. And, you know, and
the military. Test them out, too.
Well, test them, and it's a sort of arms bazaar. So then you can have these arms bazaars with the girls and the bikinis draped over the missiles, and the sheikhs walk around and say, I have that one. Of that one. That's what they do, you know, in those arms bazaars. So it's great for sales. It's great for the military-industrial complex. It's great to keep the Americans in place so they're saluting a flag and hand on the heart. It just all really works well for the military-industrial complex. And it's good for the stock market, too. Wars are.
And yet those who are enlightened or those who feel the way you do or those whom you stir up and whom you make see beyond the kinds of things that are out there and the appearance of what is presented in the media and so forth, seem very impotent. Is there any cause, civil rights, let's say, the nuclear movement, any cause that Americans would be mobilized and be able to rally behind? I mean, when you're talking about changing the healthcare system and you're talking about changing the nuclear madness, average citizens feel a tremendous sense of impotency. Average citizens who are concerned and who are passionate, even to some degree, resembling the kind of passion you have.
Such rhubarb, isn't it? I don't understand that sense of impotence. I came here, I was a woman, that was a strike against me, and I was an alien, like, you know, E.T. Yeah, and I led the movement, helped too, against nuclear weapons and nuclear war, and I just did it. This place is a democratic vacuum. I don't understand why people feel impotent. What is it? Are they so drugged on Prozac and television and all the rest of the stuff that keeps people... like, not there.
You have an advantage in being an outsider, perhaps, though.
Yeah, I think it's helpful. Yeah. It's like, who is that Frenchman? De Tocqueville. You do get...
America Through Foreign Eyes.
You do get a different perspective when you come from outside. It is useful, as I think Americans get when they come to see our funny old country and our silly politicians and, yeah.
How do you feel about Australia these days, by the way?
Not too good. We've got a really fascist government at the moment who wants to go nuclear big time. They're really revolting. And they're saying, well, why don't we become the world's repository for the radioactive waste, you know, of all the reactors in the world? I mean, it's disgusting. It's unbelievable. And his name's John Howard. Is he a little wimp? I mean, he's worse than that. I've got a rude word, but I won't say it.
Can you say something about what we should do about nuclear waste?
Yeah, leave it inside you. Leave it where it is. And you know what that'll do? Close down all the nuclear power plants in the world. Wouldn't that be a good idea?
Yeah.
If you take it somewhere, it just empties the fuel pools and they can make more. Yeah. Leave it there. Yeah.
Americans are not aware of how dangerous it is also, are they?
Well, they are when they live around the reactors and they have a high incidence of cancer and their kids are getting cancer. But, you know, it's really future generations that will bear the legacy. With them waking up in the morning, their babies being born deformed with teratogenesis from the, you know, the plutonium and stuff getting into the fetus, and their testicles being contaminated with plutonium, and the breast milk contaminated with strontium-90 that's leaking into the food chain, and.
So what are we doing?
We've done very evil things in my lifetime. By God, we've done evil stuff. It's Pandora's box. We took the lid off. What do we do with it? Don't ask me, Michael. I'm only a physician. If you ask any physicists, they don't know. But they've always said to me, the nuclear power plant people, they said, don't worry. They said, we're good scientists. We'll find the answer to radioactive waste in about 20 years. And as 20 years gone by, they haven't. And I feel like saying, well, you've probably, you know, I'm going to tell you you've got a pancreatic carcinoma. You might die in 6 months, but don't worry, I'm a good scientist. I'll find the cure in 20 years. And that's the sort of logic they use, but they'll never find. How can they have the scientific arrogance to say they can find the answer to the storage of radioactive waste that lasts for 500,000 years? I mean, it's beyond my imagination. It's like thinking about infinity. How dare we? How dare we have done what we've done?
I had forgotten about this, but a number of years ago, I had occasion to interview the head of one of the heads of physicists at Livermore about the Star Wars defense, and it was one of those items that wound up in Herb Kane. I'm not even sure how, because at the end of the interview, he presented a sweatshirt to me, and he said, Michael, I wanted you to have this. You were a worthy adversary. And it said, Star Wars, not a weapon, but a shield. And I had one of those, I actually had one of those immediate inspirations where I said, this is what we heard from Dalkon. And the reason I bring that up is because, I mean, aside from it being kind of a funny anecdote and a good metaphor, is the fact that Star Wars is once again being... Mm-hmm. I mean, the research is on once more. I mean, what do you make of this?
Friend Clinton. Yeah, he's a terrific
I mean, we thought it was over when Reagan left, didn't we?
Yeah, Reagan. You remember he used to have that sort of model with a plastic yellow shield over America, and the bombs to go bonk, bonk, bonk. I mean, that was where his head was at. But Clinton just likes to please. He's got a fatal flaw, an Achilles heel he needs to be approved of, and the ones he needs approval from are those in power, and they're the military-industrial complex. And the universities will get the money, and it's going to violate the anti-ballistic missile treaty and make the Russians even madder. I mean, we're heading to catastrophe.
On that pleasant note, let me go to our audience and find out what's on your minds and what kinds of questions you have for Dr. Caldicott. In the back, please.
And we need to leave the meeting at this point. You heard a conversation between two friends, the Australian physician and author, Dr. Helen Caldicott, and public radio talk show host Michael Krasny. It was recorded by Jennifer Krill and Curtis Overacre at UC Med Center in San Francisco in April 1999. Helen Caldicott has been a passionate and inspiring speaker on issues of nuclear disarmament for over 30 years. She founded Physicians for Social Responsibility, was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, and wrote several books, among them Nuclear Madness, If You Love This Planet, and her autobiography, A Desperate Passion. TUC Radio is supported by listeners like you for a one-hour tape of Helen Caldicott in conversation with Michael Krasny. Send $10 to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. For a credit card order, call toll-free at 877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE.